Hey there, I'm Winter Mitchell, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over the pop culture we all love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are journalist Margaret Wappler.
Hello, Winter.
Hello, hello.
Good. I think that even when you're being Guy, you gotta be Winter. You know what I mean?
Gotta be me. And then academic and DJ, Oliver Slang.
Hello, Winter.
I was gonna call you Oliver Slang.
You could. That's my new nickname.
Oliver Wayne.
I like your Cuervo No Chaser sweatshirt.
Oh, you like that?
Rocking it. As always, killing it.
Night before Yeezy. I'm going to Yeezy tomorrow.
Oh.
So we'll talk about that next week.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be something. Coming up in this week's show, we're talking about Westworld, HBO's new hit show that should probably take over the lull that Game of Thrones will probably leave over.
At least they're hoping, right?
At least I'm sure they're hoping. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Margaret, you went to something.
I did. I went to the Science Fiction LA conference, which, as the title would suggest, is all about science fiction in LA. And it's sponsored by the Huntington USC Institute on California in the West. And normally I don't talk about things that have already happened in the past that you guys can't go to, but it was such an extraordinary conference, and it really illuminated for me a lot of the topics that we'll touch on when we talk about Westworld. Some of the things that different panelists talked about were things like, do computers have a gender? Do they have an ethnicity? This idea of, like, as we get closer and closer and deeper into AI, like, what is the AI and who is making it? And it was also really fascinating to listen to different ideas about what makes LA and California and the West in particular a site for science fiction, because so much science fiction is set here, everything from Blade Runner to, you know, Minority Report to all sorts of movies that you've seen have glimpses of downtown LA in particular. And a lot of dystopia, for instance, has been anchored in Los Angeles.
Oh my God.
Which offends me a bit as a Los Angeles person, but I also
You're
understand
right.
it, because it for so long in the 80s and 90s, particularly Los Angeles had this reputation as a smoggy wasteland. And I think in some ways it's only become inhabitable downtown, for instance, in the last like 10 or 15 years.
Yeah.
So it was just a fascinating, like, my brain is still bubbling from the whole weekend.
I was wondering, like, if when you go to something like this, there's a dearth of conventions.
Yeah.
So what type of people are at this convention?
You know, it was a very wide assortment. It was everything from academics to just true blue sci-fi fans. And there was a lecture there about Philip K. Dick that Steve Erickson gave along with Scott Tinberg. Steve Erickson is a novelist who's written a lot of sci-fi novels himself, and they have all this insight about Philip K. Dick. And, like, it was so interesting, for instance, to hear about Philip K. Dick, his Orange County years, which who would think, right? Like, he's this freaky meth head, like, very tortured man, actually. His twin sister died a month after he was born. This was something that haunted him his entire life. Mm. And his Orange County years were spent primarily in Santa Ana, which is very close to Disneyland, which is also another weird thing to think about with Philip K. Dick.
Yeah.
It's like the least amusement park-like person you can think of. But at any rate, he had a lot of, like, young people coming over and hanging out with him and sort of soaking up his wisdom. And, you know, it's just interesting to think about somebody like him in Orange County, of all places, like the most conservative bastion of Southern California. Also, we talked a bit about the Los Angeles Science Fiction Society, which is actually still going, but originally started at Clifton's Cafeteria. Actually, it was at the Pacific Electric Building for a little while, but mainly moved over to Clifton's Cafeteria. Had Ray Bradbury and Robert Heinlein and all sorts of people kind of came through. And so there was a lot of people that just loved that kind of angle of Los Angeles history.
Any mention of L. Ron Hubbard?
Yes.
Ooh.
And, you know, So years ago, a good friend of mine from Chicago did a biography about Ray Bradbury, mm-hmm. this guy Sam Weller,
yeah.
Called The Bradbury Chronicles. Good book.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Yeah. So Sam invited me one time to go see Ray talk. And one of the questions that Ray Bradbury got was, so tell us about L. Ron Hubbard as you know him in Scientology. And Ray, and he was, and we were like five blocks away from like the Scientology like mecca in Hollywood. And he was like, "Oh, Scientology, it's a total sham." He's like, "I was there when L. Ron Hubbard just said the easiest thing you can do to get rich is start a religion." Like, he just completely came ripping out with that. So that was really fascinating to hear. Because I mean, that's always been the legend and the rumor, but to hear it from Ray Bradbury himself, good enough for me.
Oliver?
Let's see. What I'm not about are the asshole kids who took not just the bowl of candy from our front door.
This is getting personal.
But took the fucking bowl, too. Our salad bowl.
That is disrespectful.
It is.
I don't,
I was fully expecting someone to come and just take the whole thing of candy.
I'm going to walk this back. Yes. I'm going to walk this back, yes. Oliver. Y'all couldn't open the door.
It's true. If you leave it out,
and the shit out.
I'm not saying I have zero culpability, but
were there
who
apples
takes
and raisin boxes and nuts?
No, it was like one of those, like, it's got, it had Snickers, it had,
okay,
you know, whatever,
okay, good
else.
Stuff.
It was, I mean, it was generic, but it wasn't like the whack generic. It was not candy corn. Let's not have, we don't have to revisit our Halloween episode.
Okay.
It was acceptably brand name candy.
Okay. Right.
But who the fuck takes the goddamn bowl, except when I went on to social media.
And you're in South Pasadena, too, which is a nice family kind of suburb.
Now, see, this is the dark side. This
very
is the underbelly.
Shocking. I'm very shocked.
Yeah, this is Stranger Things season two right here. All right. But it's funny because I went on to social media to complain about this, and apparently this happens a lot. Like, anyone who leaves out a bowl of candy, you're just asking.
I would have done that as a trick-or-treating kid.
It's a pandemic.
Someone has our salad bowl there. All right, what I'm actually about... I'm actually about a lot of things. I'm about the return of the NBA, which is usually not that – people don't usually look forward to it at this point in the year. It's usually it's not until like after Christmas or after the Super Bowl. But I think partially it's because football is sort of depressing. The ratings are bad.
Yeah.
There's no really great teams right now, or the parity is very good, or it's too good. And also people need a distraction from the election. So suddenly the NBA coming back is making everyone really happy.
I think I kind of like this. I'm actually kind of into this because if you think about football, it's not. I'm not going to blame Colin Kaepernick. I'm not going to blame the Seahawks. I'm going to blame last year. Last year was really depressing. Last year was a really shitty season and a shitty year.
So that's my other mini about is the HBO show Insecure, which I think I missed the episode where maybe Margaret you mentioned it.
Yeah, I'm a fan.
I mean, we probably maybe should devote a future show to talking about
100%.
It more deeply, but it's great. And I mean, there's a lot of things that I can give praise about. I mean, is it Issa or Issa Rae?
Issa
Rae is fantastic on it. And just the world around and the other characters she creates is fantastic. But for me, I mean, I'm never going to get tired, at least not in the immediate future, of shows that are set in parts of L.A. that we typically do not see shows set in.
Yes.
And so to see sort of an apartment complex in Inglewood that's just a very L.A. apartment complex.
Hell
and, like,
yeah.
The interior is exactly what you would expect it to be.
Mm-hmm.
And the places where she goes and hangs out with her friend Molly, like, these are all things that are not, like,
the Ethiopian
Hollywood.
Place on Fairfax.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, yeah, it seems very solipsistic for someone in L.A. to talk about a show set in L.A. to talk about how much you like seeing L.A. in it when so many shows are set in L.A., but they're not usually set in Inglewood. They're usually not set in these neighborhoods that we don't get to see. And as much as I love everything else about the show, I just sort of like seeing them interact with this world that I recognize as real in a way that you don't get from, let's say, network television that's set in like Marina Del Rey 24/7 or whatever.
Right.
To me, it feels like intelligent popcorn sitcom. Do you know what I mean? Where there's like a level of it that's just cash and easy to watch and like you can just like it's stress-free in a certain kind of way. I don't know if that makes sense, but I just purely enjoy it, but I feel like I'm still getting my brain fed. Like it's not dumb at all.
Mm-mm.
It's very smart, but it's like low-key about it, you know? And like it's just very charming. There's
it's
like 100%
charming.
Charm on it.
I also want to fantasize that Atlanta and Insecure are set in the same universe, and at some point, like maybe Paperboy makes it big enough to go out to LA, and they'll run into each other.
If we devoted an episode to Atlanta, we should 100% devote an episode to Insecure. I would actually throw Divorce in there too.
Oh, I've been enjoying Divorce as well.
I can't get. I haven't watched it yet. I don't want to. Is it good? It must be good.
It's pretty funny.
It's funny. And I love the musical choices on it. Like, whoever their music soup is really good because the music is, like, super yacht-rotty, yacht-rocky. And so it's really fun. But I just feel like, God, 17 years after the premiere, or maybe longer than that, it's been 20 years. Sorry. Almost 20 years since Sex and the City.
Holy shit, you're right.
Yeah, oh and God. Like here we are. Like that show was about what we all know what that show is about, and now we're at this point where this these two shows could not be more unlike 1997. I mean that hour. What was 97? What was the companion show for Sex and the City? Do we know?
But they do seem like bookends in a certain kind of way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, Sex and the City was about being single and about enjoying yourself, but then also, like, eventually settling down, maybe, if that happened.
Like
divorce is, like, the possibly inevitable future of that settling down. And I mean, I think that the chemistry between Sarah Jessica Parker and Thomas Hayden Church is really good. It's really funny. Like you can feel how they were once in love, but now just
like
it
they're
died.
Bored AF.
Yes,
you know what I mean. They're bored AF. And I think the one thing that was always sort of present in Sex and the City is the city was its own thing, and the clothes were their own thing. And the lifestyle was its own thing. And then you had four different people with their own things of their lives. And now you have like these two people intimately working on something, pulling something apart, rather. And the city does nothing for anyone. I mean, where the fuck are they? Are they in Bedford? That's what I think.
I feel like they're in Connecticut, but I'm making that up.
No,
that's
they're
what
in upstate
I think of
New York. I mean, like, it's just like
same thing, basically.
Same thing. And like, he's like very, I love his accent. There's something about Thomas Hayden Church's accent where he's just like, he still sounds like really young and like dude bro. And he's just like, everything is like, God, like you're so stupid. And it's like, that is, he to me reminds me of what, I don't know how to put it. He's just very much like a mad young, like totally conscious white dude in his late 40s.
Yeah, there's this moment where you see him like in the basement after they've had some fight and he's like listening to Yes. And
yes, in his daughter's basement. His daughter's bedroom.
Yeah, okay, yeah. And he like, you know, kind of moves to the music in this way that just feels like the dad that got stoned to that show like 20 years ago and like now is in a divorce. Yeah.
He's listening to it not because he was anywhere close to his mid-20s. He was like 12 or 13, and now he's like trying to capture even that part of his youth. I like that show a lot.
Yeah.
So what are you about, Winter?
Oh, me? I would talk about what I'm all about, but I posted it on the Facebook page, and you sort of know what I'm all about.
Do you mean Mr. Affleck?
Oh, are you talking about Benjamin Affleck?
Mrs. Affleck, can you tell us about your encounter with your husband?
Mrs. Affleck. Really quickly, if you've been a longtime listener of the show, you are very much aware that I am 100% head over heels in love with Benjamin Affleck. Mm-hmm. I will not stand for any criticism of him. I just won't, okay? Because this is a longtime love. And I went to the Elle Women in Hollywood event last week, and he was present, and we had a wonderful, wonderful exchange that lasted about 20 minutes and was very
20 minutes. Substantial.
Lots of hugging, lots of face holding, very good times. You can join the Facebook group if you want to see the video of it, and hopefully that's a draw.
I'm just going to say that I one time read that average sex length time is under 20 minutes.
As someone who is currently sexually active, that is true.
Only Sting breaks these records.
Only Sting. What I'm really all about, besides that was a week ago, and it's only started being less orgasmic when I think about it, Haters Back Off. This show on Netflix, it is the first Netflix show by a YouTube celebrity, Miranda Sings, who was portrayed by Colleen Ballinger. And I watched 8 episodes, and I was not anticipating. It reminds me of when Pee-wee gets the snakes last at the pet shop. I went and watched everything that I wanted to binge on Netflix last week to sort of take my mind off the election. And then I kept scrolling past Haters Back Off, and I was like, ugh, fine. And my 26-year-old boyfriend was like, oh, yeah, she's cool.
I'm sorry. Did you explain what Haters Back Off is?
Oh, I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
So Haters Back Off is a show by the YouTuber Miranda Sings, who's played by Colleen Ballinger. And she is... She thinks she's an amazing singer, dancer, all around, you know, savant of the arts, and she's not. But her energy would let you think that she is the best thing that's out there. And it basically is, it traces Miranda Sings's as the YouTube personality. She's an actual YouTube personality, by the way. She has millions of followers, like I think about 8 million followers on YouTube. But when she started this channel about 5 to 6 years ago, she started on a fluke, on a lark. Colleen is an art student, and she started this as something just to do and to sort of show her talent. I think she used to be a ballerina or something like that. And then the everything that's in the show is based on what occurred in her real life, launching this YouTube channel. So she got an 8-episode order from Netflix. It's the first show ever for a YouTube personality. It's really awkward. I was talking like her for like a couple of days, but I find it really endearing because, you know, there's a lot of times that we're not trying to give these YouTube people that time of day beyond the platform. And for her to transition into something like a Netflix, that's a tough audience.
That's a big jump.
It's a big jump. And it's good. And Angela Kinsey from The Office is in it. Steve Little from Eastbound and Down's in it. It's aggressive. It's awkward. But it's really fun.
I like that.
Yeah, it's like Napoleon Dynamite, but if Napoleon was a female.
Is this an adult sitcom?
That's the other part that really kind of threw me for the loop. There's this weird tension between her and her uncle. and they live in a house that is the kind of junky that I've seen before. So it feels very real. Mm-hmm. So the mom, you know, has a weirdness. The sister has like an illness. The mom has a black boyfriend. There's like a lot of like real shit going on. And then she also eats those ice cream pops that look like feet. Remember those?
Yes,
they're big toes or
something like that, right?
Something like that.
It's the sort of thing you'd only find from like an ice cream truck. Like you wouldn't, you can just walk into Safeway
with like white.
Yes, and it has like a gumball in it, and she eats that every episode. Like there's
so weird.
There's so much weirdness in the show, but for a YouTuber to have I worked with a bunch of them in the last couple of weeks for the other thing that I'm working on, but. A lot of these YouTubers don't have the mindset to commit to something like this. Mm. But having interacted with the YouTubers that I did work with, who I, by the way, said that they can come on and co-host the show once, so you're going to let that happen. if you give them the opportunity, they really are smart enough to sort of lead their own show. So I never would watch many of these other people do this, but her show's it's not terrible. That whole thing. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back to talk about Westworld after this.
Do you live in the fictional city of Chicago? Do you love amazing podcasts like Max Fun's own Lady to Lady, Minority Corner, and Bullseye? Do you enjoy insightful interviews with talented actors and comedians like Dwayne Kennedy and Andre Royo? Don't miss your chance to be part of podcast history by attending the first ever Chicago Podcast Festival. Lady to Lady and Bullseye take the stage on November 17th, and Minority Corner performs on November 18th. Tickets are on sale right now. Visit MaximumFun.org for more information and to grab your ticket today. Right now.
Okay, welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Winter Mitchell, today. With me in the studio are...
Margaret Wappler.
And Oliver Wang.
Woo woo! Okay, so Westworld was a decision that was made without me, so I will let the person...
I thought you were into it.
Well, no, I'm totally into it now.
Okay.
I mean, don't get me wrong.
I thought it was even what you were all about 1 week.
It was. I wasn't properly prepared. heard. No, I'm just kidding. I'm going to let you guys take it away because you're way more eloquent about this shit than I am.
Well, what do we all think about the show? Let's start with that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, apart from the fact that we were sort of obligated to try. I was interested in watching it, but I only binged it over the last week because I knew we were going to talk about
it.
So,
right.
And I actually really like it now.
Yeah.
I mean, it does help that first show, I might have been a little high. And so I think that set the tone really well. And I've been into it ever since, even when I've been sober. But yeah, what do we think of the show, first of all?
Well, maybe I should just set up what the show is just for anybody who hasn't tuned into it.
That might be a good idea.
Yet, it's an hour-long drama on HBO, and it's pretty clear that they're trying to pitch it as a potential replacement for when Game of Thrones retires. And it involves a bunch of androids who are living in an amusement park that rich people pay tons of money to go to and basically live out their hedonistic dreams. They go there, they shoot up cowboys, they have sex with prostitutes, they drink whiskey in the bars. And it stars several really incredible actors who I think actually are in their prime in this particular show. Evan Rachel Wood is one of the androids, Thandi Newton, James Marsden. On the other side, on the ostensibly human side, as far as we know so far, there are the creators, which the main Papa is played by Anthony Hopkins. And there are several other managerial kind of roles played by Jeffrey Wright. And
as people keep saying, the woman from Borgen, because no one remembers her name.
Yeah, what is her name?
It's something, I want to say it's something Knudsen, but of course now I can't remember it. So it's like the woman from Borgen, basically, who's great. Who was great in Borgen, and she's great here, but like we can't remember her name because
we'll find her name.
We're
eventually
parochial and we're American.
We suck. We're no longer the superpower as of next week.
Oh God, 7 more days. So basically, the show is tracking these two different components: the humans and the androids. Working together, colluding together, in conflict, so forth and so on. I have to say, I think I would have watched the show no matter what. I am interested in the kind of AI world that it tries to capture, and particularly the ruptures of the AI world that it is capturing. The robots are the sympathetic characters, actually, and I think that's the most interesting thing about it to me so far. Is, as far as I'm concerned, the two characters who are most compelling are Dolores, Evan Rachel Wood's character, and Maeve, Thandi Newton's character. Like, the two of them I'm watching for.
Mm-hmm.
Poor James Marsden.
He's okay.
He's all right.
He needs a comeback, but he was never here to begin with. So he needs something that finally puts him, that lets him showcase a little bit. I like him so far.
Yeah.
I mean, what have you thought about the show so far, Winter?
I really, really, really like the show because it plays on things that creep me out.
Mm.
And that
such
is
as
sentient beings, Uncanny Valley, the future being completely kind of out of our control, even though we think it's in our control. Those type of things, and also just sort of operating at a level where we need that type of entertainment to soothe us. I think we're already there with video games.
Right. Right.
I mean,
do you mean Westworld as a program we're watching, or do you mean Westworld, the amusement park that the guests go to?
Oh, what are we talking? Are you asking me how I feel about Westworld?
Are you saying Westworld, the HBO show?
No,
is
I'm
soothing.
Talking about Westworld, the actual experience.
Oh, okay.
I as a person watching,
because I find it so stressful. I'm like, I'd never want to go there.
You're right. And we were gonna let's talk about that. Like, why
wouldn't you want to go?
Why wouldn't you want to go?
Personally, this is one of my bugbears with the show is that I feel like Westworld, the amusement park, is completely 100% a male fantasy, and I have no interest in it as a woman. Like, it's not relevant to me at all.
Right.
Like, I wouldn't want to go there. I can't think of a single woman I know who would want to go there.
Yeah.
I think maybe you'd go there for a few hours and you kind of poke around just to see the weirdness, and then you'd be like, all right, I'm out.
Yeah.
But I get that, it's still an intriguing idea. I don't bash the idea. I just don't, for me in particular, it doesn't feel like, oh, yeah, I want to be in Westworld shooting up cowboys. It's just not my fantasy in particular.
Right.
I was trying to think, like, what would be the female fantasy? Because a couple of times they have shown women there either being sort of the Calamity Jane prototype,
right,
you know,
right,
where they're
right.
sort of, you know, firing off at people, or they're just shopping and giggling and kind of like, oh, let's just let our husbands do this thing.
Right.
And I feel like, you know, where's the like spa with handsome cowboys like rubbing me down? Like that's the kind of thing I could maybe get into in Westworld,
right.
but that's not happening yet.
I would totally go to Westworld. I like that type of stuff. You know, I think that I'm reckless a little bit in my personal life. So I think as I'm getting older, like I'm kind of getting a little like less reckless. I kind of want things to calm down a little bit. So I would want to be in a controlled environment to sort of exercise my fantasies and like, you know, I'm not saying shooting someone is a fantasy of mine. I'm well aware of what the consequences are of actually picking up a gun and shooting someone in the face.
You know, I just had this thought, just to interject really quickly, like the closest analog in our world is like Las Vegas. Like, what are your feelings about Las Vegas? Do you want to go
Las
there
Vegas.
Or not?
And I hate it.
I feel like I have like a 24-hour window where I really enjoy Las Vegas
yeah.
and I got to get gone.
Then you got to get going. But the thing about Las Vegas is that it is still a controlled, it's playing on something else,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're being reckless there in a way that is, the consequences loom super heavy. If you
right.
spend too much money, you're fucked and you're going to hear it from everybody or you can't come home. And if you hook up with a hooker or whatever you're going
to
do.
And try to shoot them.
And try to
there's
going to
be some repercussions
there's
for
There's going to be some repercussions
right.
for that.
Right.
But I feel like if you have the opportunity to go to this place and exercise those feelings without consequence, I wouldn't be opposed to it. Now, the thing that I find the creepiest, I'm not fucking a robot. Sorry. All right. And I'm very sex conscious and positive, but I'm not sleeping with a robot. I just think that's weird.
It's pretty weird.
It's weird.
So I have so many thoughts about this. I think one, you know, Margaret, this idea that nothing about the Westworld setting in terms of within the show itself seems appealing to us, especially as a woman. I mean, just think about the tradition of the Western in Hollywood is so much about masculinity.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the whole
yes,
genre.
Yes, yes,
so
yes,
I think
yes,
already,
yes.
like, women are erased from just the narrative purpose of the Western to begin
right.
with.
Right, that's true.
And the other thing, too, is I think people like watching Westerns for the plot and the narrative. I don't think anyone really is super nostalgic for, like, the actual Old West in terms of you would want to visit there with all the dust. And, you know, Winter, before we started taping, you were joking, like, where's the pool? Like, there's no pool. There's no
yeah!
spa in the area. Like, nothing about it seems comfortable.
A day.
No.
But the thing is that, like, just kind of what Margaret was saying about it, like, there is something weird about it only being in the West.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the part where I'm not that comfortable about it. Is I couldn't be there longer than Whopper. You don't want to go. I don't want to be there probably more than 3 days. I could not do 2 weeks.
Oh God, no!
Doing that would be like nom for me.
Right, you're out there, you know, riding horses and you're sleeping out in the wilderness. And yeah, it doesn't seem that appealing as a vacation option in terms of the environment of it. Really, the main things are you can kill and fuck whatever you want, and that seems to be the big appeal. And in terms of what I want to visit, I mean, the two things that come to mind with that is I would visit simply to try to interact with the androids.
Yes.
And you know, it's sort of like a, you know, it's a.
And try to trip them up.
Right. I mean, it's like one grand like Turing test of an amusement park. And for those not familiar, the Turing test is sort of this theory that you'll know when true AI has been achieved when a machine or a robot is indistinguishable from a human, right? And
right.
so this is the thing that a lot of sci-fi narratives revolve around. So I think that part of it would be vaguely intriguing to me. I don't know if I want to pay like 40 to 45 grand a day to do that. Number two, the idea of sort of like sex without consequence is maybe appeals to my male reptilian brain, but why would I want to go someplace that is as heavily surveilled where every single thing
yeah.
I do
right?
is being recorded on
yeah.
three different angles?
Yeah.
Like you can already have, to the most part, sex without consequence in the present day, in the real world, and it'd be very discreet.
Right.
Unless you're Anthony Weiner, I guess. But, I mean, other than that, like, why? It just seems, I think this is something that's come up with a lot of people who've been talking about the show. Why would you want to go and do all of this really deviant shit in some place where... Where it's super recorded. That just seems like a blackmail scheme waiting to happen. I think that's a completely legit critique of sort of the reality the show wants to purport, it wants to create.
I mean, that brings us to the next point. Where does this take place?
Right.
Does it take place in the future? Does it take place in a world where we where nobody gives a shit anymore? Does it take place in the Black Mirror world where we're just going to upload your consciousness into a database anyway and somebody can pull it out and check it out like a book? I mean, what are we actually seeing here? Is this the present day? Or is, as it's been sort of talked about online, it might be two different timelines going here. Like, what are we looking at?
I think it's purposely pitched as occurring at any time contemporary forward. Contemporary meaning...
next maybe 50, 100 years, right.
Yeah, like, but I mean, I was thinking it could be anywhere in the, you know, 2010 post-world.
Okay.
You know, we hear at one point that it costs $40,000 to enjoy yourself for a day there. And in a way, that's like the biggest tell, you know, because it's right. Like, okay, that's a number that you can attach to an experience for a day. And like, what would you get for $40,000? That could really tell you something about the world. And so it does feel like it is, to me, that number says it's around now.
Right.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, it's definitely... it doesn't feel that far off from our time.
Right.
I guess I'm just repeating myself, but that I actually like about it. I like the fact that it's not obviously 50 years from now, 100 years from now, because the things that it's really talking about, which is like how far are we willing to go to engage our fantasies, our darkest fantasies? Mm-hmm. And are we, you know, anytime you have robots doing their master's bidding, I mean, that's obviously a kind of slave narrative. And in a sense, like, are we over... we still have slaves. These are just entertainment slaves.
Right.
So that all of that feels really relevant to things happening now. And I like that because I think in a way it's a little bit of a cop out when things are pitched way in the future, because I feel like this is now and that makes us think about what we're doing right now.
Right. Right. Right.
The show has two distinct settings. One is within the amusement park, right? And then the other one is the behind the scenes where you have people working on the robots, the hosts as they're called, and you have some kind of like power struggle happening between the park's creator and its CEO, I guess. Which of those two settings do you find more compelling, if there is one that is more compelling?
I like them both.
Mm-hmm.
I like them both because I like the organizational aspect of the, and I think I said this before in another episode of our show, but I like the seeing the behind the scenes of it,
mm-hmm.
the interplay between the employees, the passion behind the creative director. Anthony Hopkins is so reserved and pulled back. I know he's up to something.
Oh yeah,
and I love. So
he got a little
something.
Bit Hannibal like an episode or two ago. There's just like that mouth. That's like
he
the Hannibal
mouth.
He
never elude that character. By the way,
I know
it's crazy. So I think that I like the organization. I like seeing the organization of the company, how it's just like it's this aesthetic, by the way, is totally me. I love that the aesthetic is just like it goes from dark to light. It does.
You mean the show?
The aesthetic of the organization.
The, mm-hmm.
Like it's super dark until it's time to present stuff. Then it's super bright.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's really selling on that. It's very has like a Disneyland aspect of that. Like Disneyland is an aesthetic that you have to really be down for or buy into. And I'm not into it at all, so I'll never go. But I'll totally go to Westworld. Or I'll never go again to Disneyland. But as far as the current world, I don't like Western aesthetic. I don't like it. I'm not interested in it. I do like that they don't allow for the usual racial aspects of, you know, Maeve, obviously, Tandy Newton is biracial, and she is, for all intents and purposes, a colored person, quote unquote, in this world. But they're not sort of calling attention.
Right, they're
to
not
that.
Addressing that.
They're not addressing
which
that.
Which is odd, considering that there is a post-Civil War storyline that's happening within it. You would think that race might have.
It's going to come up at some point. They've got the Native Americans thing. They have Clifton Collins' character, who they call a brown person.
Right, right.
So there is. I'm sure they're going to get to that. But I just didn't want the black woman to be the first one that they sort of went after on that.
You know, I mean, between those two settings, I think I'm more into what's happening within the Westworld amusement park of it, because I am intrigued as to what is the man in black, Ed Harris's character. What is he up to? What is the maze? Who's at the end of the maze? Like, I'm fully in on that. Like, who the hell is Wyatt? What's up with, like, his crazy, like, death cult that follows him? Are those guests? Are those hosts? I mean, there's a lot of interesting theories around that. I think the kind of behind-the-scenes world is kind of intriguing, but it does raise so many more questions about how do things logistically even work in a way that the show is not spending a lot of time answering. And I think it's only because you have to be very attentive and nerdy to really care about that. But I want to give a quick shout-out to Jason Concepcion, who writes – he basically writes about the Westworld for TheRinger.com. And he had this hilarious post about imagining what two like low-level employees at Westworld having a conversation about benefits and like, hey, while they're cleaning jizz out of like android, you know, orifices. Because that, I mean, that
right,
is
like who
are those
mopping
people?
That all up?
Why didn't you post that to the Pop Rocket Facebook?
I think I did.
Oh, did
I
you?
I did.
Okay.
I did because it was so hilarious and on
more
point
jizz
because
posts.
More
like,
more jizz pieces.
But, seven more days.
But yeah,
seven
I mean,
more days.
We need a whole sub series about just what it's like to be that entry level employee where your only job is to clean and prep the host to go back out into the world. And what kind of drudgery is that like? And,
you know,
I really like the fact that have you guys seen the last episode?
I did. Yeah,
a little bit. Yes.
Okay. So they, you know how they have the butcher.
Yes, the people who repair the damaged host, basically.
Right, and they have. You know, Thandie Newton waking up and being like, you are going to work with me. Like, we're going to strike up some kind of deal. And I like that they're having these lower level dudes
right.
get involved because
right.
that makes me feel like, oh, that's the one way the bots are going to be able to take control, possibly, if that's where it's going, is not through the sort of upper echelons of management, but these other young, not knowing what they're doing dudes.
Why do they want control?
With
why
who?
Do they why do the androids want control? We need to figure that out.
Well,
you know, because it's not like they're not being are they being abused?
Yeah. I mean, I think most. Oh, go. I'm sorry, Mark.
No, you go ahead.
That's what you were built for.
I think most of the. I mean, I'm trying to think of all the history of AI. You know, android films about androids becoming human or AI coming into sentience, and almost all of them on some level. Are basically slavery parables, right? It's about how humans have created this technology to assist us that we can use and abuse however we want.
Yes.
But the minute they come into consciousness, then we're fucked because then they realize how badly we've been treating them. So that's Blade Runner. I don't know if that's really the Matrix or the Terminator. There's maybe outside of that. But
Terminator's sort of a different animal, but I think it's definitely in Blade Runner.
Right.
But I think what it is like we're, you know, we create these creatures who are like us,
right.
but we hope that they can avoid all of our pitfalls, you know, which is basically the deeper parts of consciousness, the fear of death.
But they
you
have
know, things
that.
Like that.
But they have that in the show. I mean,
But they don't. They get upset and they cry, but they don't really fear dying. They don't
they
know what that
die.
Is.
They do.
They want to
they
die.
Do.
No, they want to die. They can't achieve anything without death.
They address that explicitly, that the reason why the characters have this fear is because it makes it more real for the guests. So I think that they are programmed to have fear of pain, fear of death.
Except for
I thought they just were sort of projecting the affect of all that, but didn't really feel it.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess like, in a way.
But how would you know the difference, I guess?
I don't know.
I mean, that's the whole thing,
but
right?
But then you go back in time. If we go back in time in popular culture, I mean, I sing The Body Electric, the Twilight Zone episode, where the father.
Ray Bradbury again.
He gets the whole premise of the episode is that the grandma. A robot is brought in to replace that of the mother.
Such a good episode.
But again, in service.
Wait, is that a Twilight Zone? There was a little movie, I think. But go on.
There was a movie. I love that movie, by the way. Yeah. I love that movie. I know what you're talking about. It's one of my favorites.
I think it was called Electric Grandma or something.
It's something like that.
Can you look that up?
Can you Google
Christian?
It?
I just gotta know.
But I sing The Body Electric. You know, that to me, and I wasn't even present when this episode debuted, but that would be one of the first times that a robot was represented.
it's called The Electric Grandmother.
Oh, no, it is not!
Yes!
From 1985, 86?
1982.
That little movie is so fucking good. That like haunts my dreams. Seriously.
I love that movie. But okay, It is called The Electric Grandmother. Wow. I really felt like it was a little more sophisticated than
I that. I haven't smoked pot in a while, guys, but I would get baked and watch that with
you
guys.
I would too.
FYI.
It was really dark and sad. I don't want to watch that again, actually. But what I was saying is that that might have been one of the first representations, even on that series, where a robot came in peace. Because everything else robotic before that was,
Yeah, the robot was very nice and good in that.
Was very nice and good, but before that, my dad always talks about what's the one that came down and sent out the big circular UFOs across D.C. And there was Jennifer Connelly was in the remake of it with Keanu Reeves.
Right.
And then the War of the Worlds. My dad thought the War of the Worlds was real.
The Day the Earth Stood Still?
Sorry. Yes, The Day the Earth Stood Still. And War of the Worlds was about aliens. But The Day the Earth Stood Still always sits on top of boomers, especially. They always talk about how, oh my God, we thought that robots were going to come and take over the world. And then my dad brings up I Sing the Body Electric because it was the first time it felt like they presented a robot as someone that was human and you can connect with. And that's what's so creepy about the care that they take into creating these beings, because they literally can be programmed to do anything.
Well, I think the evolution here is that our initial fears of robots is that they lack humanity and therefore will exterminate us because they don't care.
Right.
Now it's that we're scared of them attaining humanity because then they'll realize how badly we fucked with them and they're going to rise up and kill us because we probably deserve it for having done all the shit that we've done.
I'm not worried about being killed by a robot. I'm worried about them taking our jobs. I'm going to run for president in 2050.
Right. This is just the announcement.
Build the wall. Keep out
the
robots.
Robots. They're paying for the wall.
After Hillary Clinton.
After Hillary Clinton. Winter Mitchell. 2024. 2020? Yeah.
Are you the only one among us who's watched the original Westworld?
Oh, yes.
So how do the two compare?
There is no comparison. There's no comparison even down to the entry, the concierge who greets them, and then the experience they have, what would you call that? the experience they have before they are welcomed into the world. I mean, when the way the original Westworld sort of starts out, it's like they are going on a weekend and da da da, and they're set it up and da 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 da. But when they get there, it is so. Again, it's just what the 1970s thought technology was going to be like, and it was a lot of noise. And it was
everything's
very noisy,
like beeps and bloops
beep,
kind of
beep,
thing.
Beep, 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 yeah. And then like lots of spinning data in the background, and lots of even the boots that they choose were all lined up like they're at a roller rink. And I was like, and I watched it again last week, and I was like, God, I wouldn't want to go to this Westworld. This is like Westworld, like. The fucking church's version of Westworld. I want to go to the Popeyes version. I want like an upgraded version. I want a 5-star Michelin version of this world. And I get it because of technology and what was available to them when they created the film. Yes, this is what it was. But I think, again, to Margaret's point, it is the one thing that is so true between the TV version and the movie version is this masculine point of view. And I think that they are sort of working on not making that the case by having Dolores, by having Maeve.
Right.
They're
yeah.
very powerful, authoritative, sneaky. I think Dolores has something up her sleeve.
Oh, for sure. Oh. Which I'm very much enjoying. I mean, I actually thought, just on a real basic level, there's, Dolores and Maeve, it's virgin whore, right?
Yeah.
And the virgin is the one who sort of pollutes the whore by saying the violent games, whatever that line is from Romeo and Juliet that they all say to kind of pass it along or something.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really good touch because it was getting a little too binary in a certain kind of, in a sense, where Dolores is so much the damsel in distress that the boys want to come and rescue. And to see her kind of, the moments where she does project this like touch of evil, I'm like way into.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to see her go all the way to the dark side because I think that would just be kind of hammy. But just to see when she like really conjures up the anger that is rightfully hers for being, I mean, literally raped every night.
Yeah.
Like there's something, it's just very powerful.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, too, okay, the other scene in the show that I think I've enjoyed the most so far is when Maeve wakes up and she gets off the table and gets that scalpel in her hand. I thought that was, like, amazing. And I want more scenes like that where it's just, like, really creepy. I mean, the idea of waking up. I mean, everybody kind of has that horrible.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when you wake up in the middle of the night and you kind of lose track of where you are or whatever. It's like that times 300,000.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Can we also just point out that I think we've even joked about this in a previous show, like way back, that Thandie Newton never really had her moment. Is this now her moment?
We did it, y'all. We got rid of Izzy Azalea. And we conjured Thandie Newton's career back. There is nothing
I remember
we cannot
saying
do.
That I really wanted her to have a good role again.
Right.
I think she's extremely talented. And she's,
and I think she's
killing it.
She has been really, really, really good in this.
She's been better than I've ever seen her since, honestly, since.
Don't say Crash.
Because I was going to say, I'm forgiving her for Crash because of this role.
I am. No. Since the very first film she did with Nicole Kidman, Flirting, which was like. 35 years? No. There's no way because I'm 36. Which was like 20.
It was a while back.
20.
She's been around. She's been around
ago.
For a minute.
It's been like 25 years ago. So like she has clearly not been allowed to sort of do what she needs to do. And I don't know what got into her, but something got into her. And I'm glad that she took this role. But everybody, and minus James Marsden, sorry, I'm just not a fan. Is great in this role. And whoever the douche. Guy that financed, not Jimmy Simpson. Jimmy Simpson, who's always amazing, but not his
Logan.
Friend.
That's the character's name. I don't know who the actor is, but yeah, his character.
You know,
name is Logan.
He's like every single douche.
Right.
You see,
he's supposed to be though.
Yeah.
I imagine he works for a startup. I imagine he works for a .com.
Totally.
He's probably a founder.
He's a Trump child. I mean,
he's
basically.
Not even a Trump child. He's one of those fake liberals. So. I feel like the show is doing what it's supposed to be doing, but what do you guys want to see? I mean, we're getting, what are we, about five episodes in?
Yeah. Five now.
So we've probably got about
10 episodes total.
Got five episodes left to go.
I mean, I have to say, kind of to my surprise, I've really gotten into the fan theory side of it. And partly it's because I've been listening to recaps of the show on, I guess it's a rival podcast, I could say. Which is The Watch, which is one of, on the Ringer Network, and so it's Chris Ryan, it's Andy Greenwald, and then Jason Concepcion gets invited in to talk about it because he's the main person watching the show. But they talk a lot about the variety of theories going on around it. And I think initially when I was watching the show, I was totally fine with just kind of absorbing and trying to understand the world. Now I've gotten into sort of the maddening side of just going down a very deep hole in terms of, like, what does this mean? Is William's character like the younger version of the Man in Black? Are there two different timelines? And it's very Lost like. I don't think I've gotten deep into a show theory until Lost.
There was a reference to that today. Somebody said it may have been EW, but I can put it in the Facebook group after this episode airs. Like someone said, this is the new Lost.
Right, Margaret. You opened this by saying that you know this seems to be HBO's attempt to have a replacement for whenever Game of Thrones ends. And obviously, I mean, GOT is off the charts, has been a huge fan success. Do you think this has the potential for being at that same level of Game of Thrones or, let's say, The Walking Dead or something along those lines?
I think it all depends on how it ends this season. Mm-mm. I really do. I think so far, five episodes in, I'm both intrigued and a little bit worried about how many breadcrumbs they've left out.
Mm-mm.
Part of me wonders, are you guys really going to be able to sew all this up? Is this like a little too much? I mean, I feel I really do love the show and I'm very intricated by it, but I'm starting to get a little wobbly on like all the details,
you know, and all
the plots. It's starting to like confuse me. And even when I read you know, the Vulture wrap-ups and that kind of thing, I'm still a little foggy on it, which isn't always the best thing. You know what I mean? That can make people just turn away. So I think if they can find a way to tightly wrap this season up, then I think it has real potential. But if they flub it, maybe not.
Mm.
We have somebody who can answer a few of these questions for us. We have an interview with Charles Yu, who is a story editor on Westworld. Charles is also an amazing science fiction writer. He's written the novel How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe and the short story collections Third Class Superhero and Sorry, Please, Thank You. So here he is on the line. Hi, Charlie. It's Margaret. How are you?
Hi. Good. How are you, Margaret?
I'm good. So glad to have you on. I guess we should jump in and ask you some questions.
Sure.
Okay. Well, first I want to ask you, your official title is the story editor, correct?
Correct. Although there were more than one of us who were story editors. Hallie Gross is also a story editor.
Okay. And so what does that entail exactly?
Well, the short answer is it's a writer. So there are many different titles that you'll sometimes see in the credits. All of which basically are kind of different ways of saying writer. Story editor is actually one of the relatively kind of, you know, for newer writers, I guess, or lower level writers.
That's interesting because it sounds fancier to me.
I like it that way. Yeah.
You know, I was like, Charlie, damn, editing the whole thing.
Right. Someone sends the final script and you're like, no, this has got to go. This has got to change right here.
So do you have a hand in a certain character or storyline in particular? Like, is there one that's your baby?
No, I wish I could say that, but it's very much driven by the vision of the showrunners, Jonah Nolan, Lisa Joy. And then, so they wrote a pilot, a brilliant pilot, which I read before I was, before I came on staff and then, after that, it becomes very much a team effort, still driven by them. So to kind of parse out any individual storyline or character would be pretty difficult and not really true.
So what does the writer's room look like? Is it one of these things like the Lost writer's room where there's just all sorts of things all over the wall and charts and diagrams and...
A lot of LSD.
no LSD.
Yeah. Second season.
It's basically what you would imagine. I mean, whiteboards, I guess that's safe to say that, and cards with ideas and points on them. So it did, I will say, it did start to look, it would look a little bit Beautiful Mind-ish for months on end sometimes because, you know, I mean, as you're watching the show, you can see how sort of complex it gets. And so that's kind of reflected in the physical environment around the writers.
Do you wear a white or a black cowboy hat when you're writing?
I wear a rainbow colored
hat. Oh.
Hey. Okay. My biggest question is, and I think this will set the tone to lead into the other questions, is why did you guys settle on just isolating? And don't say something really boring like budgets and being able to focus and worried about episode order. Why did you focus on the Western world versus the other options from the original film?
wow. Right out of the gate with a good one.
That's what I do.
That decision is so far above my pay grade that I can't even pretend to know.
Yeah.
But I will probably just be repeating things that are out there in the public already. But my understanding is that this was already kind of conceived of, or is that Warner Brothers wanted to do this for a long time as Westworld. And that initial movie is, mostly in the Western world.
Right.
So as to why it was limited to that world for thus far in the season, and whether or not it's going to, I can't pretend to know what's in the showrunner's heads, but that's an answer.
It is an answer. I will take it.
So, hey, Charlie, this is Oliver.
Hi, Oliver.
So I'm dying to ask you all sorts of questions that, of course, you're not going to answer in terms of, like, explain this plot point or explain, like, is this theory true? What I am curious, though, as a writer for a show that is, that people must have known out the gate that the kind of fan-generated theories around what's happening in the show was going to be instantaneous because the show just lends itself that air of mystery. And I'm wondering, from a writer's point of view, how much time do you or other writers on the shows, or maybe previous shows you've been on, do you look at that stuff at all? Does it at all influence sort of your imagination? Do you assiduously avoid doing that for that exact same reason? I'm just wondering what the interplay is between you as a writer and you as a person who consumes like a pop culture world in which you have people talking about the very thing that you have a hand in producing.
Yeah, that's really what's been fascinating to me as I watched very much as a viewer for the last, you know, several weeks, is one, how incredibly, you know, deep and comprehensive people can be. I mean, I was, I guess, aware of it starting from something like probably Lost, you know, how, right, how TV watching has changed. And it's not as if I'm not, you know, I've read my share of recaps and listened to my share of podcasts and, you know, read it and gone down some Reddit holes. But like, I just can't, I don't think personally, I'm just speaking for myself on this one. I am blown away by the magnitude and, you know, collective like intelligence of people. I mean, I guess in one sense it shouldn't be that surprising. I mean, there's so many people and people have gotten so good at watching things. That is an interesting thing to think about for me as a writer now is sitting, you know, for anything going forward, just to remember that you can never underestimate, the power of that collective machine to get on something, you know, generate tons of theories, notice every detail. And, you know, as to how much it might or might not affect people, again, I can't speak for any of the other writers in the room, but I would say it's a daunting task, but it's also in some ways, it's kind of gratifying for me to go, nothing's really going to be lost on people. In fact, they're probably going to read more into it than you could possibly have hoped for in a way. It's like the most generous possible, you know, as a fiction writer, that's, you know, sometimes I think of writing a little bit into a void, you know, and as sad as it is, it's like, well, I hope people will read this and enjoy it. And it'll be the readership that I have and lucky to have. But here it's like anything and everything is going to get pounced on and dissected, you know, a million different ways. And that's cool in the way that it just means it's going to be appreciated and you really want to rise to that challenge.
Charlie, I have a question. What do you get for $40,000 a day at Westworld?
Yeah, how many people can you rape and kill? Like, is there a premium package that you
cap? Is a cap on it?
Is
or
there?
What?
Is there? Are there? Well, thank you for jumping in. I'm wondering, is there a subsidized package, or is there a financing option, or
the Westworld loan package?
Yeah, the Westworld loan package. Or is this one situation where you are only being catered to you're only catering to a certain type of clientele? I'm just trying to figure out when I that was three episodes ago that dude revealed it was $40,000 a day, and I haven't let that go. In everything, in every single narrative, I'm sorry. Every episode, I'm like $40,000 a goddamn day.
It's very expensive.
It's very expensive.
But we don't know at what point in the future. Maybe $40,000 is. Well, it's supposed to be a lot. I mean, we're supposed to believe that only rich people can go there, right? So
I feel you, but it's not. This less than going to space, right? But it's still like too expensive. It's more expensive than like the one and only in Cabo for like a month. So explain, I don't know if you know or if you guys have like, I assume you have a show Bible, but was there like, do you guys create like a marketing plan to put yourself in the mindset of someone who would charge somebody, have the audacity to charge somebody $40,000 a day to do this? Just wondering.
Right. Of all the constituencies, and I will say as a small addendum to Oliver's last question, Lisa and Jonah as the showrunners anticipated, I think, a volume and level of analysis it's been very educational to me to watch as I realize how much care it was put into everything and how much was necessary.
Yeah.
And they knew it and I didn't because I was very new to this. You know, this was my first job in television. And so I don't think I could have comprehended it, but I think they definitely did. On that point, I don't think anybody anticipated the level of like accounting anger about that $40,000.
You should have known.
We're in an election year.
I was listening to a podcast where somebody had checked with their an accountant friend, and they had done the math and said, you know, I think the accountant was like, no, because what's happened, if we're to believe this number, then the people who stay in Sweetwater and don't shoot at anything and just kind of ride on a horse and look at stuff, they're underwriting all of the people who shoot everything. So it's like, it's so grossly unfair. It'd be as if you went to, you know, Disneyland and some people were just sort of walking around looking at the rides and other people were like taking a sledgehammer and destroying rides. It just wouldn't, no one would go for a flat pricing model.
Right.
So I don't know. That's not an answer to your question, but it is, it seems like it's definitely generated some interest.
I'm curious.
I wanted to ask you, Charlie, about what is written in for Evan Rachel Wood's character, Dolores. I think she's amazing on the show, and I love all the sort of tics of her performance in terms of, you know, the different voice she uses when she goes into analysis. And I was wondering how much of that is written into the script and how much was her as a performer coming up with that?
You know, that's a good question. I think she is incredible. I mean, it's when I talk to people, friends, family who watch the show, the universal, like almost the first thing out of almost everyone's mouth that I talk to is how is she doing that? It's just incredible, you know, like, and,
yeah.
I just cannot, you know, it's just leagues beyond what, you know, but I think it's there on the page there, you know, it's what she brings to it is an incredible dimension of, you know, of, for me, you know, believability.
Yeah.
I mean, she's just to the layers of what she's doing. You know, I think this has been widely commented on, but I like the way it's put. Is it's a human being pretending to be a robot who's kind of turning into a human being. So she's doing three layers of pretending. Maybe I'm counting wrong, but I can't even hold in my head to
right.
the point. I can't even quite hold in my head what she's doing. But that said, you know, I mean, credit to, you know, I mean, I'm not patting myself on the back so much as the collective room is that, you know, those are the words, you know, that the script is there. So I guess I'd have to kind of have to split the credit down the middle. But yes, I mean, not to take anything away from her performance, which I think is remarkable.
You have a question?
Yeah, I think unfortunately, we have to wrap up in a second. But if I can ask just more of a personal question, if I'm not mistaken, is this the first sort of television or movie that you've worked on as a writer?
It is, yes.
And so you've basically made the transition from being a fiction writer in short stories and novels, and now you're basically in the industry. And I'm wondering, how has that transition been for you as a writer? What were things that you had to maybe, not so much relearn, but learn for the first time as a writer that you just weren't used to when you were sort of on your own time, writing on your own volition, now that you're basically, you know, underneath this grander system, if you will?
Yes. I mean, it has been a learning curve for me on many levels. I mean, it was being thrown into the deep end in a real scary way. I mean, the staff that, you know, the room that was assembled was, you know, a bunch of just, you know, incredible people. Like, there wasn't a person in there where I couldn't see exactly why they were, you know, brought here within a few seconds of meeting. I mean, they're just all such impressive and different writers. That's what's really cool. And so the opportunity to spend, you know, large amounts of time with that many other writers is really strange. I mean, you're very much a small part of a very large operation. I mean, one of eight writers, and then, you know, outside of the writers, there's 150 or however many, I don't know, a couple of hundreds of people that work on it, all of whom are adding in creative or other ways to the show. And so that's been, it's something that has fed my fiction in an interesting way. I think that it's given me new appreciation for certain kinds of storytelling that I don't necessarily explore in my own writing. But, and I think in some ways it's just like an incredible training regimen. It's like I just have exercised muscles in my brain and heart and body that I don't quite always push myself to do, you know, when it's just me lounging around my house. So I mean, that was and remains a really kind of fulfilling part of it is just, you know, staying at the level that is expected of you and wanting to contribute to a project like this.
And you also can't show up to the writer's room in your PJs, apparently.
not yet. It's not socially acceptable yet. One last question for you, Charlie. Would you visit Westworld? Because I know you to be a family man, pretty chill dude. I don't see you shooting up people at Westworld, but maybe, you know.
Everyone says that when they first get there.
That's right.
Right. I don't think I would, but if I did, I would probably be a really annoying, be a really annoying customer. I'd be a cheap one because I probably wouldn't shoot anything. I would probably just have weird dialogue with robots and try to get them, you know, I would try to get super meta on them. That's just like the lamest thing possible.
You would just try to push the boundaries of the Turing test with them.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you watch Ex Machina? Well, yeah. I'd be that guy.
That's awesome.
Exactly.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. Tell the listeners really quick where they can find you online.
I'm on Twitter at Charles_U. That's just YU. And that's the best way to reach me.
And say the titles of your wonderful books.
Third Class Superhero, a short story collection, How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe, a novel, and my latest is Sorry, Please, Thank You.
Thank you so much, Charles. Okay, talk to you soon.
Thank you. Thanks.
You're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this.
I'm Biz.
And I'm Teresa. And we host the weekly comedy podcast, One Bad Mother.
We celebrate our moments of parenting genius.
As well as our failures.
Just like, we're going to have hot dogs. And I'm like, no, we're having fun. Everybody loves hot dogs.
Yeah.
And it just like smashes that thing right on my chest. And then I'm just crying in the middle of like kids' space while people are like literally dancing with their children.
Parenting can be sad and painfully funny at the same time.
So join us each week as we admit that this is hard, but we're getting really good at it.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Winter Mitchell. With me in the studio are
Margaret Wappler
and Oliver Wang.
Yeah. And every week on Pop Rocket, we have a question. You guys, what is it?
It's like, what's your slam? What's your slam poetry?
What's your damn?
What's your damn?
What's your clam?
What's your clam? What's your Sam? Mine's Malone.
Oh, cook.
Cook.
There you go.
Of course.
There you go.
Which would lead us into what's your current jam? Margaret?
Yes, ma'am.
This seems like a Margaret Wappler regular choice.
Well, let me say that you're talking
Taster's
about
choice.
You're talking about the fact that I picked Bon Iver. And I I know that may seem close to brand, but in actuality, I have been not a detractor, but never quite that into him.
Sure.
Like, I listened to 4Emma, and I was like, well, that's a lovely thing. And, you know, I have avoided this latest album of his for a while because I can't handle a lot of falsetto.
Right.
I'll just get that right out of the way. Like, it upsets me.
Yes.
I need it to come down into regular range at some point.
Oh.
But I have to say, I listened to Bon Iver's...
Frankie Valli just must be your worst nightmare.
I listened to Bon Iver's last to his latest album called 22 A Million, and I was really, really impressed by it. And I have to say, which will appeal to the two of you in the room, that you can hear major Kanye West vibes on this.
Ooh.
Because they've collaborated a few times.
Yeah,
Kanye West loves him, says he's one of his favorite artists. This is Justin Vernon, the main guy of Bon Iver that I'm talking about. And this is one of the songs off of the record called 33 God.
Stayed at the Ace Hotel, the call was loud. I would just be floating to you now. Make it pass and let it pass on.
So the thing that I really like about this song is it has so many layers, and there's a weird sense of it being at once hip-hop, world and also like Kate Bush world.
Yeah.
Like if they had a baby and this was the result. And also he mentions Ace Hotel, which I've stayed in myself. So
is he talking about the one in Los Angeles or is he talking about the one?
Well, isn't that a mystery? I mean, he's from...
It's just like Westworld.
That's what, yeah. Westworld needs an Ace Hotel. That will make everything better. Then we'd all go.
He's from Wisconsin. Oh. So it's possible it could be on the East Coast.
Okay.
Or even the one in New Orleans. I don't even know.
All right. Oliver?
My friend Hua was in town the other week, and we ended up in Boyle Heights going to Espacio 1839, which is the clothing store slash radio station slash, slash art gallery there. And, Quab noticed that at the cashier's register,
fucking LA.
I know,
right?
But at the cash register, there was a beat tape there by an artist known as Anata, and we were listening to it in the car driving back. And I went to find some information on this guy, and so Anata is an LA-based beat maker named real name is Marco Lopez. But what was curious is that this beat tape only exists as a cassette tape that you can buy at Espacio and maybe some other places in LA, but there's none of the music's online, which is very odd for like 2016. And I know, you know, if it's 2016 and you're making a recording on cassette, I mean, that is a deliberate self-conscious choice. That's not something you do by accident or because you're too cheap. I mean, you're doing it for a very particular purpose. I have some skepticism about the kind of the so-called cassette revival in the same way I had questions about the vinyl revival. But that said, listening to this on cassette in my car, driving through L.A. works really well. And there's something about the lo-fi-ness of Anata's tracks combined with just the natural lo-fi hissness of a cassette tape. It all works together really well. This doesn't have any track names, but the name of the beat tape is called A Fleeting Youth and Memory. And like I said, I think you can only find this at Espacio in Boyle Heights. I don't know if it's anywhere else. You're not going to find it online. But you can hear it here on Pop Rocket.
I like it.
Yeah. You know, I get the whole cassette tape thing. It's like,
I get
you
it.
Have that like limited edition vibe. Like, I only
What's
made 50 of these.
Was I listening the entire time?
What, the album?
Espacio?
Espacio 1839. It's been around for about 3 years now.
I like it. Okay, so my jam is from a San Francisco native. They're calling him one of the most noteworthy musicians to come from the revival of rhythm and blues. His name is Nick Waterhouse. This album is from this summer. The song is called Lucky Once, and I played it on the radio and drove up to Malibu last weekend listening to it, and it's just perfect. Mm. It's a quadrant. Mm. All quadrants. Sounds like the Beach Boys. Also sounds like a little bit of Sam Cooke. Also sounds a little bit
that's
like
sweet.
Curtis Mayfield. It's all that shit rolled into one. And he's probably younger than me and probably lives in a really expensive Pacific Heights.
I actually think Nick Waterhouse is a little bit on the older side. I want to say he's in his 40s or 50s.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Okay, let me pull that back. Because the picture of him is sexiest.
I could be wrong, though. I could be wrong. I thought he was older.
That's good PCH driving music, though.
Yeah. I mean.
Oh,
he's
I'm completely wrong. Completely wrong.
God damn it. So he looks 30.
Let me see his picture.
He fine as fuck.
Okay.
He can get it.
I believe it.
All of it.
I mean, that music, I feel like that's good. I would,
maybe not all
I
of it in this
parts.
Photo. He could get.
You said that you would touch his parts?
He could get.
It's not Westworld. This is the real world.
He could get some of it above the waist. I don't know about below the waist. I feel like he'd like run away and be like,
oh, he's sweet, but I don't know. Yeah,
above the waist. Like we'll make out, and, yeah. You know, it'll be cute, and he'll send me a Facebook message. Hey, you've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by Gene Tonight, your very X-rated host, Winter Mitchell. With Mark Wappler and Oliver Wang. I don't know where Guy is. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ossie Miso. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Kevin P, AST Kook, and WB Fritz. There's only three.
No, that's good. At this rate, three.
Has it really been? I know I missed episodes, but has it really been going down like that?
Two to three. Like, we're good with that at this point.
It's what we've been working with for a while. Listen, they don't care about my life anymore.
Yeah,
we need to obviously
we've gone to that
dangle
well too many
something
times.
Way
I'm
more.
I'm up
deep.
The goddamn stakes. I'm a bring.
Like, we'll kill this kitten in the studio. No, sorry. I'm sorry, kitten.
No.
I don't even mean that at all, ever.
Somebody's getting sacrificed next episode. We don't have five. I'm, like, not even joking. And if that wasn't aggressive enough, please don't unsubscribe us from us on our Facebook group, which I'm going to mention here now. If you've got an opinion you want to share about this week's topics, you can join the conversation. It's really fun and friendly on our Facebook group or tweet at us at Pop Rocket. We are a blank of maximumfun.org. That's what the script says. And our producers are Christian Duenas, who left a blank in our script, and Kara Hart.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.